Right now, like right this exact second, beneath your feet and just all around you, there is this massive, completely invisible nervous system keeping your city alive.
Yeah, and it's something most people never even think about.
Exactly. I mean, I'm talking about smart grids balancing these massive megawatt loads of electricity across your neighborhood, right? Or underground pipelines that are, constantly measuring flow rates so they can detect microscopic water leaks before they turn into actual sinkholes.
Or even those autonomous logistics fleets navigating industrial ports in the dead of night. It's really this silent symphony of data.
It is. But here is the crazy part, and the reason we're doing this deep dive today. The cellular networks keeping all of those critical sensors connected, like the legacy 2G and 3G links that we built the first generation of smart infrastructure on, they are actively being unplugged.
We're in the middle of this huge global telecom sunset. As we sit here, carriers all over the world are just dismantling those old networks.
Which means millions of critical sensors are, they're effectively about to go completely dark if they aren't migrated.
Yeah, it's a structural shift that honestly most people are entirely unaware of until something suddenly breaks. The hardware that forms the connective tissue of our modern municipalities, it's just being forced off the spectrum it's lived on for decades.
And the transition isn't just, swapping out a SIM card.
Oh, no, not at all. System architects are fundamentally rethinking how critical infrastructure communicates from the ground up.
And that structural shift is our mission for today's deep dive. We're looking at this huge stack of incredibly detailed engineering reports on what the industry calls the sovereign stack and the evolution of cellular IoT.
Yeah, and we're going to unpack the three modern protocols that are sort of stepping into the void left by 2G and 3G, which are NB-IoT, LTE-M, and 5G RedCap.
Right. And what I found so fascinating in these sources is that it isn't just about internet speed. I mean, when a system architect is designing a water grid that needs to last for, say, 20 years, they are weighing these brutal physical constraints.
Oh, absolutely. They have to balance radio signal penetration against battery chemistry, right?
Yeah.
And mobility requirements against raw hardware cost.
Not to mention weighing legacy vulnerabilities against modern cryptographic edge security.
Exactly. The criteria for success in this domain is completely divorced from consumer telecom. Like, if your smartphone drops a 5G connection while you're listening to audio, it's just an annoyance.
Right. You just wait a second and it buffers.
Yeah, but if an automated substation drops a connection during a cascading power grid failure, that is a catastrophic event.
Which brings us to the overarching philosophy of the sovereign stack that these reports really emphasize. The whole idea is moving away from cloud dependency.
Right, the concept of island mode.
Yes, island mode.
Right.
I found this to be the most compelling part of the architectural reports. In the classic, Internet of Things model from the 2010s, everything was totally
So it
centralized.
was all about the cloud.
Right, so a temperature sensor on a municipal pipeline would read a value, transmit it over a commercial cellular network to some carrier's core, which routes it out to the public internet into like an Amazon or Microsoft server.
Where some algorithm decides to open a valve.
Exactly. And then the command travels all the way back down that exact same fragile chain.
And it's an incredibly fragile chain. I mean, you have a dozen single points of failure there if the AWS availability zone goes down, or a backhoe accidentally cuts the fiber optic backhaul from the cell tower.
Or there's just a massive BGP routing error on the wider internet.
Right. If any of that happens, your local water valve just stops working.
Which is insane for critical infrastructure.
Completely. So the sovereign stack philosophy demands a localized edge reality, a completely private, localized cellular network where the edge nodes talk directly to a local physical controller.
So the internet could literally physically cease to exist, and the microgrid would still balance power perfectly in island mode.
That's the dream. But to achieve that level of resilience, the very first hurdle these architects face is purely physical.
Right, before we even talk about software or routing, we have to deal with radio frequency propagation.
Exactly. Because if you want to connect a water meter that is bolted to a pipe, sitting in a basement, behind a heavy iron door, under a foot of reinforced concrete.
The physics of standard radio waves just completely break down.
They do. Which is why the industry developed our first protocol, NB-IoT or Narrowband IoT.
The subterranean protocol.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's engineered specifically for massive static deployments in really hostile RF environments.
Because when we talk about burying sensors in concrete or, placing geothermal probes under heavy wet soil, standard cellular signals suffer extreme attenuation.
Right. The radio waves are absorbed, they're reflected, scattered, they just die. But NB-IoT was designed from the ground up to survive exactly that kind of physical punishment.
So the core metric the engineers look at here, and the reports mention this constantly, is maximum coupling loss, or MCL.
Right, MCL.
And the reports highlight that NB-IoT achieves an MCL of 164 decibels, which, to put that in perspective for anyone who isn't an RF engineer, 164 dBp is roughly a 20 decibel improvement over the legacy 2G GSM networks.
And those old 2G networks used to be considered the absolute gold standard for long-range coverage.
Exactly. And in the logarithmic scale of radio physics, a 20 dB improvement isn't just a slight bump, right?
No, it's massive. It means the signal is orders of magnitude more robust. I mean, it can punch through a steel bank vault.
Okay, so let's unpack this. How does it actually do that? The reports talk about the power spectral density advantage.
Right, so the underlying mechanism for how it achieves that 164 dB MCL is this brilliant manipulation of the Shannon-Hartley theorem and power spectral density.
Which sounds incredibly complicated, but it's really about focusing energy, right?
Exactly. So standard 4G or 5G LTE operates on very wide channels. A commercial network might use a 20 megahertz or even a 100 megahertz wide channel to push massive amounts of data.
Like when you're streaming 4K video on your phone.
Right. But a battery-powered IoT device only has a finite amount of transmit power, usually around 23 dBm.
Okay.
If you smear that 23 dBm across a wide 20 megahertz channel, the power at any specific frequency is incredibly weak.
It just gets diluted.
Exactly. It gets lost in the thermal noise floor the second it hits a physical barrier like a concrete wall.
Okay, so the analogy that came to mind when I was reading this is fluid dynamics. It's like you have a fire hose, but you only have a trickle of water pressure.
That's a great way to visualize it.
Right. The water just kind of dribbles out of this huge hose and doesn't reach very far. But if you restrict the aperture, like if you put your thumb over the end of the hose,
the pressure skyrockets.
Exactly. You take that exact same 23 dBm of transmit power and force it through an impossibly tiny frequency band.
And the reports note that NB-IoT operates on a sliver of spectrum that is just 180 kilohertz wide.
Wow, from 20 megahertz down to 180 kilohertz.
Yeah, and in some uplink configurations, it drops down to a single 15 kilohertz subcarrier tone.
That's practically a microscopic hole.
It really is. By concentrating all the radio energy into that micro sliver, the signal energy density shoots way above the noise floor.
So that focused spike of energy acts like a laser, just punching right through the concrete and steel.
That concentrated power spectral density is the entire magic of narrowband. At the receiver end cell, the cell tower, the signal-to-noise ratio is vastly improved.
Because the tower knows exactly what tiny frequency to listen for.
Exactly. The receiver only has to listen to that tiny 15 kilohertz sliver, which effectively filters out the broadband background noise of the entire universe.
That is just elegant physics. But, I mean, there has to be a catch. The architectural trade-off seems pretty severe.
Oh, it is. Squeezing the spectrum that tightly severely limits your data throughput. We are talking about maximum data rates well under 100 kilobits per second.
So no video streaming.
Definitely no video streaming.
But I guess that's perfectly fine for the use cases it targets, right? Like a moisture sensor in an agricultural field doesn't need video.
Right. It just needs to wake up once a day, transmit a tiny string of text that says, you know, soil moisture at 42%, and go back to sleep.
And that brings us to the battery chemistry aspect. Because the payload is so incredibly small, and the protocol allows the radio to aggressively power down into these deep sleep modes.
Like PSM or power saving mode and EDRX.
Right. Because of those modes, you can supposedly get 10 to 15 years of operational life out of a single battery.
Yeah, a primary lithium thionyl chloride battery. You literally bury the sensor in the ground, pave over it with asphalt, and forget about it for a decade.
Which sounds like a miracle for city planners. But when I read further into the reports, there was a massive caveat.
Yes, that battery life is the promise on the spec sheet. But the practical reality of NB-IoT introduces a massive operational limitation.
The mobility problem.
Exactly. It completely lacks connected mode handovers.
Okay, so let's explain what that means. If I'm using my smartphone and I get into a car, the network seamlessly hands my connection from one cell tower to the next as I drive down the highway.
Right, your call doesn't drop. Your Spotify keeps playing.
But NB-IoT fundamentally cannot do that.
No, it can't. If an NB-IoT device moves outside the footprint of its current cell tower, it abruptly loses the connection.
Just totally drops it.
Totally drops. The protocol was stripped of those handover mechanisms to keep the silicon really cheap. and the protocol stack incredibly lightweight.
So what happens when it drops? It just reconnects.
Well, yeah, but it's not simple. If a node moves and drops its connection, it has to perform a cold start.
Uh-oh. That sounds expensive, battery-wise.
It's devastating. It wakes up, scans the entire frequency band to find a new tower, synchronizes its timing all over again, and executes a mathematically intensive cryptographic handshake just to re-authenticate with the network.
Wow. And that handshake requires a massive spike in CPU and radio utilization, yeah, right?
Exactly. Doing that once a day is fine.
But if you strap an NB-IoT tracker to a logistics truck driving from Los Angeles to Seattle,
it's going to be crossing cell boundaries every few minutes.
So it would just be caught in this continuous loop of dropping the connection, scanning the spectrum, and performing heavy handshakes.
And that 15-year battery life would be annihilated in a matter of weeks. It degrades the battery chemistry rapidly.
Okay, so that's the battery side of the mobility problem. But there's also a physics problem with movement too, right? The Doppler effect.
Right, yeah, the Doppler effect. When a transmitter is moving at highway speeds, the frequency of the radio wave it emits actually shifts relative to the stationary cell tower receiver.
Like how a siren sounds higher pitched when an ambulance is driving toward you and lower when it drives away.
Exactly that. But because NB-IoT operates on such incredibly narrow 15 kilohertz subcarriers, even a slight Doppler shift can push the signal out of its designated frequency bin.
Oh, wow. So the tower literally can't hear it anymore because the frequency slid over.
Right. It causes complete data corruption. So, structurally, NB-IoT is just fundamentally incompatible with high-speed mobility.
So, it is strictly for static infrastructure, things bolted to the ground.
But
here is the major caveat that the sovereign stack architects point out, and it's this fascinating political and architectural clash.
Yeah, the carrier trap.
Right. Because if NB-IoT is this unparalleled master of penetration and battery life, you'd think every city planner would use it for their private island mode grids.
You could think so.
But the reports explicitly warn against it. They call it a carrier-tethered trap. Why?
The contradiction lies in the difference between the physical layer capabilities and the network layer requirements.
Okay, meaning what?
Well, NB-IoT is heavily optimized to run inside the guard bands of commercial LTE networks. The timing synchronization, the scheduling algorithms, the core network signaling required to manage thousands of sleeping NB-IoT devices. It's all staggeringly complex.
You can't just buy a cheap software-defined radio off the internet, plug it into a laptop, and spin up an NB-IoT network in your garage.
No, precisely the opposite. The open-source telecom community has really struggled to build reliable, lightweight NB-IoT network cores.
Because it's so tightly woven into legacy telecom architecture.
Exactly. Running it practically requires the massive, multi-million dollar Evolve packet cores operated by Tier 1 national carriers like AT&T or Vodafone.
So if a municipal water authority deploys 50,000 NB-IoT water meters, they are physically tying their critical infrastructure to the commercial availability of a specific telecom giant.
Right. And if that carrier experiences a national outage or, you know, decides to sunset the technology in 10 years, the city's infrastructure goes dark.
Which completely violates the premise of off-grid sovereignty. You can't have island mode if you're chained to AT&T.
Exactly. It traps the architect. You get the deep soil penetration, but you surrender control of your own network.
Which naturally forces architects to look at the next tier of cellular IoT to solve both the mobility problem and the sovereignty problem.
Right. So when a use case involves moving assets like tracking vaccine shipments across a supply chain or deploying wearable medical alerts or building a localized emergency grid that the city actually owns, we have to step up to LTEM.
Long-term evolution for machines, the middle child.
Yes, LTEM is the pragmatic workhorse of the industry. If NB-IoT is the extreme, uncompromising specialist, LTEM is highly adaptable.
So from an engineering standpoint, it makes a completely different set of trade-offs.
It does. The primary difference is the pipe size. Where NB-IoT squeezes everything into 180 kilohertz, LTEM opens the bandwidth up to 1.4 megahertz.
Okay, so it breathes a bit more.
It does. And because of that wider channel, it achieves much more respectable data rates, hovering around 1 megabit per second.
Which, obviously, it's not gigabit broadband, but 1 megabit is plenty to handle telemetry, firmware over-the-air updates, and robust command and control.
Exactly. But more importantly, it natively inherits the mobility features of standard LTE.
Oh, so it solves the handover problem.
Fully. It supports connected mode cell handovers. That logistics truck can drive across the country, and the LTE-M modem will seamlessly transition from tower to tower without dropping the TCP/IP session.
And without burning its battery doing those massive reauthentications every 5 minutes.
Right. Plus, the wider bandwidth makes it significantly more resilient to the Doppler shifts that plague the narrow protocols.
That makes total sense. And there's another feature LTE-M brings back that the reports highlight as a huge differentiator. Voice.
Yes. VoLTE. Voice over LTE.
This seems highly relevant for industrial safety. Like, the reports give the example of an automated straddle carrier in a port facility running on a private network.
Right, moving shipping containers.
Yeah, and if it experiences a mechanical failure, you might have a human technician out on the tarmac trying to fix it. LTE-M allows that technician to initiate a two-way, low-latency voice call directly through the machine's control panel back to the operations center.
Which is something NB-IoT has absolutely no capacity for.
Yeah.
It cannot handle real-time voice packets.
So voice capability is mandatory for things like elevator alarm panels or medical alert pendants.
It is. But returning to the sovereign stack philosophy, the true defining feature of LTE-M is how harmoniously it integrates with private, open-source networks.
Okay, this is where we get into the democratization of telecom hardware, which I loved reading about.
It's revolutionary, really. Over the last decade, we've seen the rise of SDRs, software-defined radios.
Because historically, if you wanted to build a cell tower, you had to buy incredibly expensive, proprietary, custom silicon base stations from companies like Ericsson or Nokia, right?
Millions of dollars of equipment. But today, an architect can buy a commercially available SDR, like a USRP B210, for a few thousand dollars.
A few thousand, that's nothing for municipal infrastructure.
Exactly. They plug it into a standard by 86 commercial server and run open source software, like Open5GS or SmaRin.
And because LTE-M operates within the standard LTE protocol structures that the open source community has spent 15 years reverse engineering and perfecting.
Those software stacks support LTE-M flawlessly.
So an agricultural cooperative could basically buy an SDR, mount an antenna on a grain silo, spin up SPRAN on a Linux box, and instantly blanket a 5,000-acre farm in a completely private, localized LTE-M cellular grid.
That is exactly what they are doing. The farm owns the SIM cards, they own the encryption keys, they own the routing.
The data never touches the public internet.
Never. It goes from the soil sensor in the field to the antenna on the silo straight into the farmer's local control server. That is the definition of island mode.
It guarantees data sovereignty.
Yeah.
But, and there's always a but, there is an inescapable law of physics here.
Always.
We noted that LTE-M uses a 1.4 megahertz channel. By spreading its 23 dB bone of transmit power across that wider band, its native power spectral density drops dramatically compared to NB-IoT.
Right. It loses that focused laser beam effect.
So if I take an LTE-M sensor and bury it under the same foot of reinforced concrete where the NB-IoT sensor was thriving, the native LTE-M signal is just going to shatter against the thermal noise floor.
It won't get through.
So how do system architects bridge that gap? Because a private network is completely useless if it can't reach the edge assets.
Well, the 3GPP engineers, the standards body, anticipated this structural deficit. To compensate, they built a highly controversial algorithmic feature into LTE-M called coverage enhancement modes, or CE modes.
I found the math behind CE modes absolutely wild. Instead of changing the physical radio wave, it uses this brute force statistical approach.
That's a perfect description. Brute force.
My understanding is that there are two primary tiers. CE mode A is the moderate version, which gives a slight boost to the signal through basic repetition, getting the maximum coupling loss to about 145 decibels.
Right, which is decent.
But CE mode B is the extreme tier. If an LTE-M device is trapped deep underground and its single transmission is entirely lost in the noise, CE mode B instructs the device to take that exact same data packet and transmit it repeatedly back to back up to 2,048 times.
Yes, 2,048 times.
That sounds like a glitch. How does that even help?
Well, the statistical theory is actually really sound. Every time the signal is transmitted, the cell tower records the faint, garbled noise it receives. Over 2,048 repetitions, the random thermal noise averages out to zero.
Because noise is random.
Exactly. While the underlying data signal constructively interferes and builds upon itself until the tower can successfully extract the payload.
So it artificially pushes the effective MCL up to around 155.7 decibels.
It does.
The analogy that came to mind here is standing in a chaotic, deafeningly loud concert venue.
Okay, I like this.
If I want to tell you a specific sentence and I say it once, you won't hear me over the music. But if I stand there and scream the exact same sentence at you 2,000 times in a row, eventually your brain will piece together the fragments of what I'm saying.
The message gets across.
Right, but the physical toll is devastating. I will completely lose my voice.
And for the IoT device, doing 2,048 repetitive transmissions means the radio amplifier is powered on and running at maximum blast for an incredibly long duration.
Which transforms a microsecond data burst into a prolonged, heavy current draw.
And this is the hidden trap that architects fall into. A device manufacturer will sell an LTEM water meter claiming a 10-year battery life based on the assumption that it operates in perfect line-of-sight radio conditions.
Oh, wow. But if the city installs that meter in a deep utility pit, and the device constantly triggers CE mode B just to get a signal out,
that 10-year battery life will evaporate. It drops from a decade to a matter of months.
And you cannot have municipal workers driving around the city digging up concrete to replace lithium batteries every 4 months. The operational costs would bankrupt the whole project.
So the architectural reality is that LTEM is fantastic for mobile assets and private sovereign grids, provided you are dealing with moderate RF environments.
But if the nodes are truly subterranean and you're relying heavily on CE modes, you're deploying a fundamentally flawed architecture.
Exactly. You have to use NB-IoT for that.
Okay, so we've matched the extreme low end and the versatile middle. We have NB-IoT for the buried static infrastructure where battery is paramount, and we have LTEM for moving assets and off-grid sovereignty.
Right.
But what happens when the physics of the edge node become exponentially more demanding? I mean, a modern city isn't just low bandwidth sensors.
No, it's highly complex.
Right. What if the edge node is a high-definition thermal security camera monitoring an industrial border?
Right.
Or an autonomous robotics arm in a manufacturing plant? Or a smart grid balancing node that has to process high-frequency transients in a solar array?
Yeah, LTEM's 1 megabit pipe will instantly choke on that volume of data.
It's just not enough bandwidth. We need something vastly more capable. Which brings us to the high-end challenger, 5G RedCap.
5G RedCap, or reduced capability. This was formalized in 3GPP Release 17 and further refined as eRedCap in Release 18.
And the reason it exists is because the telecommunications industry realized they had this massive chasm, right?
A huge gap, yes. On one side, you have LTEM doing 1 megabit per second. On the other extreme, you have premium consumer 5G broadband pushing gigabit speeds, but requiring massive batteries and incredibly expensive silicon.
So there was basically no middle ground for high-end industrial IoT.
Exactly. RedCap bridges that chasm. The source metrics show RedCap hitting throughputs of up to 150 megabits per second on the downlink, and the eRedCap variant scaling that down to about 10 megabits per second.
So it finally brings 5G into the IoT arena. But the name itself, reduced capability, obviously implies a severe compromise.
You don't get 150 megabits on an edge device without sacrificing something on the hardware layer.
Right. What exactly is being gutted from standard 5G to make this work?
Well, to understand the reduction, we have to look at the anatomy of a standard premium 5G device, like a flagship smartphone. To achieve gigabit speeds, modern 5G relies heavily on spatial diversity, specifically massive MIMO.
Multiple input, multiple output.
Right. A premium device typically utilizes 4 receive antennas, or 4 RX. This allows the modem to process 4 distinct spatial streams of data simultaneously, capturing signals bouncing off buildings and trees and computationally recombining them.
But packing 4 individual antennas along with their associated RF chains, amplifiers, and filters onto a small industrial circuit board is a nightmare.
It consumes valuable physical real estate, drives up the module cost, and drains power like crazy.
So the primary architectural reduction in RedCap is just severing those antenna arrays.
Pretty much. RedCap scales the hardware down from 4 RX to a maximum of 2, or in many cases, just 1 single receive antenna.
Wow, from 4 down to 1.
Yeah. And furthermore, it heavily restricts the maximum bandwidth the device can process. While a smartphone might listen to a 100 megahertz wide channel, RedCap restricts its vision to a maximum of 20 megahertz.
Okay, and there is another major hardware surgery mentioned in the engineering reports, the shift to half-duplex FDD.
Ah, yes. The duplexer issue.
Right. So my understanding of standard full duplex systems frequency division duplexing, is that the radio can transmit data and receive data simultaneously on two different frequencies.
That's correct.
But to prevent the device's own powerful transmitter from deafening its highly sensitive receiver, you need a physical hardware component called a duplexer.
Yes. Duplexers are highly engineered, bulky ceramic or acoustic wave filters. They require strict manufacturing tolerances, which means they are expensive and take up significant board space.
So by shifting to half-duplex FDD, the RedCap device operates sequentially instead of simultaneously.
Exactly. It will transmit on frequency A, stop, switch its internal switches, and then listen on frequency B. It never talks and listens at the exact same moment.
Which completely eliminates the need for the bulky duplexer hardware.
You save space, you drop the module cost, and you reduce the power draw. It's an incredibly pragmatic engineering choice.
But the mathematical reality of removing those antennas and eliminating that spatial diversity introduces what the reports call a structural deficit.
And that is the inescapable trade-off. When you rip out three of the four antennas, your physical link budget plummets.
RedCap suffers a massive 3-4 decibel coverage penalty compared to standard 4G or 5G devices, right?
It does. Its native maximum coupling loss drops to roughly 140 to 143 decibels.
Meaning its ability to penetrate physical obstacles is significantly worse than LTE-M and just absolutely dwarfed by NB-IoT.
Well, completely dwarfed.
Yeah.
If you mount a RedCap security camera on the edge of a cell radius or inside a warehouse with heavy metal shelving, the physical signal is going to be incredibly fragile.
So how does the 3GPP standard recover that lost coverage without adding the expensive hardware back in?
They shift the burden from the hardware layer to the network algorithm layer.
Okay.
The standards mandate features like slot aggregation and inter-slot frequency hopping.
The mechanics of slot aggregation are fascinating. In a 5G network, time is sliced into incredibly small increments called slots. If a RedCap device transmits a payload in a single slot, and the cell tower determines the signal is too weak to decode because of that structural deficit, the network dynamically commands the device to aggregate its slots.
Yes. The device will take that single data payload and blindly repeat it across 2, 4, or 8 consecutive time slots.
It's conceptually similar to the CE modes in LTE-M, just executing it at a vastly faster, lower-level protocol layer.
Exactly. By aggregating the slots, the network builds up the signal energy over time. And then inter-slot frequency hopping adds another layer of resilience.
How does that one work?
Well, if a particular frequency block is experiencing deep multipath fading, say, a metal truck drove past and caused a localized reflection that cancels out the signal, the network forces the device to hop to a different frequency block in the very next time slot.
Oh, so it just dodges the localized interference rapidly.
Precisely. It's a software compensation for hardware deficiency.
That's brilliant. But while the protocols are clever, the economic reality of deploying RedCap today in the mid-2020s is pretty stark.
Very stark.
The Sovereign Stack report lays out the module pricing quite clearly. If a manufacturer is building a fleet telematics router, they can buy a mature 4G LTE Cat 1 Beast chip for roughly $4 to $6.
Yeah, they're dirt cheap now.
But an early 5G RedCap module currently costs between $25 and $40.
And that 5X to 10X price premium is the primary friction point slowing mass adoption right now. For a company deploying 10,000 sensors, that delta is millions of dollars.
Because the 4G LTE ecosystem has achieved massive economies of scale, and RedCap silicon is still maturing.
Exactly. However, the system architects who are willing to pay that premium aren't doing it just to get 150 megabits per second. They are doing it to plug into 5G standalone cores.
Ah, okay. The distinction between non-standalone and standalone 5G is critical here.
It's everything. Early 5G deployments were non-standalone, meaning carriers just bolted 5G radios onto their existing 4G core routing networks.
So it gave you faster download speeds on your phone, but the underlying network architecture was still basically 4G.
Right. True 5G standalone, or 5G SA, utilizes a completely new cloud-native service-based architecture. And that pure 5G core unlocks the actual enterprise features that industrial architects care about.
And the most profound of those features is network slicing.
Absolutely.
I often see network slicing treated as just a marketing buzzword, but the architectural reality is incredibly powerful. The best way to visualize it is to look at a physical highway system.
Yeah, that's the best analogy.
In legacy 4G networks, the bandwidth is a single massive open highway. You have heavy logistics trucks, sports cars, and motorcycles all sharing the exact same lanes.
And if a massive traffic jam occurs, Say, a stadium full of people suddenly starts streaming high-definition video. Everyone is affected. The network congestion slows down everything indiscriminately.
Right. And in that 4G scenario, if a utility company is trying to send a critical latency-sensitive command to a smart grid load balancer to prevent a brownout,
that command gets stuck in the same traffic jam as the smartphone videos.
Which is unacceptable for critical infrastructure. It's dangerous. So 5G network slicing allows the telecom architect to logically partition that physical highway. They can create a dedicated, isolated virtual lane.
They construct a cryptographic wall around that lane. So the utility company reserves a slice of the 5G network exclusively for their grid telemetry.
Yes. It doesn't matter if 100,000 people in the neighborhood are saturating the macro network with video traffic. The smart grid data travels in its own isolated slice with guaranteed quality of service, guaranteed bandwidth, and guaranteed low latency.
It creates virtualized sovereignty within a shared physical medium. That's amazing. And alongside slicing, a standalone 5G core enables time-sensitive networking, or TSN.
Yes, TSN is the feature that really changes the game for factory floors.
My understanding of modern automotive manufacturing is that it relies on highly complex robotic coordination. Like, if you have two massive robotic arms welding an EV battery chassis, their movements have to be synchronized down to the exact microsecond.
Exactly. If one arm is a millisecond late, they collide and destroy $1 million of hardware. And historically, the only way to guarantee that microsecond synchronization was to hardwire the robots together using thick bundles of industrial Ethernet and fiber optic cables.
Which are the bane of industrial design. Those physical cables restrict the movement of the robots, they degrade over time due to constant flexing, and reconfiguring the factory floor takes weeks of manual rewiring.
So what does 5G TSN do?
It essentially allows the cellular network to emulate hardwired deterministic Ethernet. The 5G standard incorporates incredibly precise timing protocols derived from IK standards, broadcasting synchronized clock signals over the air to all connected edge nodes.
So you can literally cut the fiber optic cables, you equip the robotic arms with RedCap modules, and the 5G network orchestrates their movements wirelessly with microsecond precision.
You achieve total factory flexibility without sacrificing industrial reliability. That is the true value proposition of the $25 RedCap module.
It's the pinnacle of the modern industrial stack.
It is. However, there is a looming threat that overshadows all of this capability. Security. We've solved the physics of penetration with NB-IoT, we've solved mobility with LTE-M, we've solved high-speed industrial orchestration with 5G RedCap. But as this infrastructure becomes entirely autonomous and the island mode architecture decentralizes control to the edge,
the most critical vulnerability is no longer a drop signal, it is hostile interception.
The security chasm. When you read the engineering postmortems on the 2G and 3G sunset, it becomes incredibly clear that freeing up radio spectrum was only a secondary benefit.
Wow, really?
Yes. The primary driver for killing legacy networks was a global cybersecurity mandate. The reports bluntly refer to the sins of 2G and 4G.
The older networks were structurally, mathematically insecure.
To comprehend the severity of the flaw, you have to look at the historical context of the 1990s when the GSM standard was being finalized.
Okay, take us back.
The telecom operators designing the system had one overwhelming fear: billing fraud.
Seriously, not state-level hacking, just billing fraud.
Just billing fraud. They were terrified of criminals cloning SIM cards to make free international phone calls. Consequently, the entire security architecture was designed to verify the device.
The network demands proof. When a 2G device powers on, the cell tower essentially says, "Prove to me cryptographically that you are an authentic subscriber before I let you make a call."
And the device complies, using its internal cryptographic keys to generate a response. But, and this is the catastrophic architectural failure of legacy cellular, the authentication is unidirectional.
Wait, meaning the tower never has to prove its identity to the device?
Exactly. The phone blindly trusts the network. The standard literally forces the device to connect to whatever tower is broadcasting the correct network mobile country codes with the strongest radio signal, without verifying if that tower actually belongs to AT&T or Vodafone.
So that unidirectional trust is what burst the IMS eye catcher, colloquially known as the Stingray.
Yes. The mechanics of a Stingray attack are terrifyingly simple now that we have cheap software-defined radios.
Right, because earlier we talked about how great SDRs are for private networks, but hackers can use them too.
Exactly. A hostile actor can buy a USRP, load it with open-source base station software, configure it to broadcast the network codes of a major carrier, and amplify the signal so it is vastly louder than the legitimate cell towers in the area.
So they put this setup in the back of a van and drive near a target, say, a municipal water treatment facility.
And because the legacy 2G and early 4G fallback devices are programmed to aggressively seek the strongest signal, every legacy device in that facility will automatically drop its connection to a real commercial network and eagerly connect to the hacker's fake tower in the van.
Because it's louder, the hacker executes a localized man-in-the-middle attack.
And because the van controls the radio link, they control everything. They can intercept unencrypted telemetry. They can pinpoint the exact physical location of the transmitting asset.
But most devastatingly for the sovereign stack, they can inject spoofed command payloads.
Yes. They can send a forged SMS or IP packet to a legacy water valve controller that says open all valves, and the controller will execute it, believing it came from the legitimate network core.
That is terrifying. And compounding this architectural flaw is the weakness of the legacy cryptography itself, right?
Very much so. The A51 stream cipher used in 2G networks was developed in 1987. Due to extreme hardware constraints of the era and intense political pressure from intelligence agencies regarding export controls.
Let me guess, they deliberately crippled it.
They did. The cipher was deliberately restricted to a 64-bit key length. In the modern era of cloud computing, a 64-bit key is trivial to break.
Hackers use massive pre-computed rainbow tables to execute time-memory trade-off attacks, cracking A51 encryption in near real time using a standard commercial laptop.
It is a fundamentally broken architecture, which is why the migration to the new protocols isn't an option, it's a necessity.
So how do the modern standards LTEM and 5G RedCap close this vulnerability?
The foundation of modern cellular security is the strict enforcement of mutual authentication. Yes. In a 4G LTEM or 5G RedCap network, the unidirectional flaw is eliminated. The device still proves its identity to the network, but crucially, the network core must execute a complex cryptographic handshake to prove its legitimacy back to the device.
So the tower must possess the corresponding keys from the carrier's core database.
Exactly.
So if our hacker drives the Stingray van up to the water facility and blasts a massive signal, the LTEM water meter will hear it. It will attempt to connect.
But the moment the van asks for data, the meter demands the cryptographic proof. Show me the carrier's private key signature.
And the Stingray van doesn't have the private keys. The mathematical proof fails.
The LTEM water meter instantly recognizes the tower as hostile, drops the connection, blacklists the frequency, and scans for the fainter but mathematically verified legitimate tower.
It completely neutralizes standard MSI catchers. That is incredible. But the 5G standard takes it even further to address passive surveillance, right?
It does. In 4G LTEM, there is still a slight privacy leak during the initial handshake. Every cellular device has a permanent, globally unique identity number, historically known as an IMSI.
Right.
In 4G networks, before the encrypted tunnel is fully established, the device has to introduce itself to the network by transmitting its IMSI in clear text over the air.
Just shouting its ID number for anyone to hear?
It is a brief window, but it is enough. A sophisticated adversary doesn't need to build a fake tower. They could just use a passive antenna to eavesdrop on the initial signaling traffic.
They intercept the clear text IMSIs.
While they can't decrypt the actual data payloads, they can catalog the unique identities of every asset in a physical area, allowing them to track the movement of high-value logistics fleets or personnel without ever transmitting a signal themselves.
Passive location tracking. So how does 5G RedCap solve this?
Through identity encryption, known as the transition from SCPI to SCCI.
Okay, unpack those acronyms for us.
In the 5G protocol, the permanent identifier, now called the subscription permanent identifier, or SPI, is never transmitted in clear text. The device utilizes a public key infrastructure, often based on elliptic curve cryptography, preloaded onto the SIM card.
Before the device transmits anything, it uses the network operator's public key to encrypt its SUPI, generating a concealed identifier, or SUCI.
Exactly. Only the legitimate 5G core network, possessing the tightly guarded private key, can decrypt the SCCI back into the true identity.
So the over-the-air transmission is entirely randomized. A passive eavesdropper listening to the radio waves just sees mathematical garbage. They cannot track assets.
The network layer is finally hardened. We have mutual authentication defeating active man-in-the-middle attacks and elliptic curve identity encryption defeating passive surveillance.
But the sovereign stack reports point out one final terrifying vulnerability.
They do.
What happens when the physical edge node itself is compromised? We've secured the pipe perfectly, But what if an attacker breaks into the utility box, physically wires into the circuit board of the water meter, and manipulates the sensor data before it even reaches the 5G modem?
This is the ultimate frontier of infrastructure security. Oh. The paradigm shifts from protecting the network to guaranteeing data provenance.
Data provenance.
Yes. When a municipal control server receives a packet over a secure 5G link that says pipeline pressure is normal, the system architect must have absolute mathematical certainty that the data was generated by the actual physical sensor.
And hasn't been maliciously altered by someone with physical access to the board. Because if the data is tampered with pre-transmission, the perfectly secure 5G network is just highly efficiently delivering lies to the control center.
Exactly. This is the exact vector used in the Stuxnet attacks against centrifuges, feeding normal telemetry to the operators while the physical machines were destroying themselves.
So how does the sovereign stack architecture prevent that?
Through the implementation of a hardware root of trust. In a highly secure modern deployment, you do not simply wire a sensor to a RedCap modem. You physically and cryptographically bind the entire system to a TPM, a trusted platform module, or an HSM, a hardware security module.
A TPM is essentially an impenetrable silicon vault soldered directly onto the motherboard, right?
Yes. It contains its own dedicated cryptographic processor and hard-coded private keys that cannot be extracted, even if you freeze the chip or hit it with an electron microscope.
The architecture forces every piece of telemetry to flow through that vault. Every single time the smart meter measures a cubic liter of water or the microgrid registers a transient voltage spike, that raw data payload is routed to the TPM.
The TPM uses its deeply embedded private keys to digitally sign the payload, generating a cryptographic hash. Only after the payload is signed is it handed off to the cellular modem for transmission.
The implications of this are profound. Even if a hostile nation state physically compromised the sensor array or intercepted the 5G data packet midair, they could not subtly alter the telemetry.
No. If an attacker intercepts the packet and flips a single bit, changing the pressure reading from critical to normal, the cryptographic signature fundamentally breaks.
The math is unforgiving.
It is. When the altered packet arrives at the city's island mode controller, the controller runs the hash verification. It instantly detects that the payload no longer matches the TPM signature.
The controller knows the data has been tampered with, drops the packet, and immediately flags the physical node as compromised.
The integrity of the physical infrastructure is preserved because the data provenance is cryptographically guaranteed at the silicon level.
That is the realization of the sovereign stack. It is autonomous trust. Wow. We have covered an immense amount of architectural ground today.
We really have.
For the engineers and planners trying to navigate this post-2G world, the matrix is complex but clear. If the mission requires deeply buried static nodes like concrete-encased water meters or subterranean soil monitors, where maximum coupling loss and a 15-year battery life are the sole priorities, the physics demand NB-IoT.
You accept the lack of mobility and the reliance on commercial carrier cores to achieve that deep penetration.
Right. If the architecture involves moving assets, autonomous logistics traversing varied terrain, or the mandate is to build a completely private, localized, software-defined grid with voice fallback, the mobile workhorse is LTEM.
You leverage SAR-SRAN and open source cores, but you meticulously manage the battery drain caused by coverage enhancement modes.
And if the objective is the high-end industrial future factory robotics requiring microsecond time-sensitive networking, autonomous smart grids utilizing dedicated network slicing, and extreme cryptographic hardware security, the protocol is 5G RedCap.
You absorb the premium hardware costs and the structural RF deficit to gain unparalleled deterministic control.
That matrix dictates the physical deployment. But the deepest analyses of these sovereign stack architectures point to one final immense construct. We can engineer the most resilient hardware roots of trust. We can optimize power spectral densities, and we can write brilliant open source routing software. But an island mode network cannot function without access to the physical medium itself, radio frequency spectrum.
The invisible real estate.
Yeah.
It's the one thing you can't build or code.
It is heavily regulated and fiercely guarded. As enterprises, hospital campuses, and local municipalities begin to realize the power of building their own sovereign cellular grids, they hit a regulatory wall.
You cannot simply broadcast LTEM or 5G waveforms on arbitrary frequencies. Doing so would cause catastrophic interference with commercial telecom networks, aviation radar, or military communications.
Historically, to get a clean block of spectrum, a commercial carrier had to spend billions of dollars at government auctions to buy an exclusive national license.
And a local hospital or a municipal water authority obviously doesn't have $2 billion to buy spectrum rights just to run a private network.
Which is why the regulatory frameworks are slowly being forced to adapt. In the United States, we are seeing the rise of CBRS, the Citizens Broadband Radio Service.
It is a highly innovative, tiered, shared spectrum model in the 3.5 gigahertz band. It allows private enterprises to utilize clean cellular frequencies without purchasing a massive license.
Utilizing dynamic spectrum access databases to ensure they don't interfere with incumbent military users, it democratizes the airwaves.
It does. But as thousands of factories, smart cities, and localized AI edge networks all try to stand up their own island mode infrastructures, the demand for that shared spectrum is going to skyrocket.
The physical protocols give architects the tools to build the sovereign stack, but securing access to that localized private spectrum will become the most fiercely contested technological battleground of the next decade.
Whoever controls the invisible frequencies in a given geographic area ultimately holds the keys to the autonomous infrastructure of the future.
What a profound reality to grapple with. The battles of the 21st century won't just be over physical land or fiber optics. They will be fought over invisible bands of oscillating radio energy. I want to sincerely thank everyone tuning in for exploring these deep architectural concepts with us. The next time you see a silent utility box on the corner, an automated forklift moving through a warehouse, or a security camera mounted above a crosswalk, take a closer look. Think about the cryptographic handshakes, the power spectral density punching through the concrete, and the invisible battles for spectrum sovereignty that are constantly raging just out of sight, keeping our modern world alive.